Are steroid injections of any good whatsoever for back pain?
Did advertising influence our use of testosterone?
Startling new information about cancer mutations.
And for stroke patients, treat at the mothership or drip and chip?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on March 24th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Okay, Rick, before we started recording, we were talking about this terminology, drip and ship. That's in JAMA Neurology, taking a look at, hey, how do we manage folks who are having a stroke, have had a stroke, when we don't have all the capability right where we are?
It was about 20 years ago when we discovered that people with stroke benefited if you infused a medication, a clot-busting agent called TPA, than if you didn't treat them at all. Fast forward about 20 years later, and we discovered that not only do they benefit if you dissolve the clot, but if you actually mechanically disrupt it, there's even a better outcome. So based upon the early treatment, using an IV infusion or dripping it in, we developed primary stroke centers. And now with this new invasive therapy, we now have comprehensive stroke centers. And the comprehensive stroke center, by the way, has to be manned 24/7 with people that are experienced with that. The primary stroke centers manned with people that are equipped and educated in how to give the IV infusion. So if you have a stroke, Elizabeth, is it best to get you to the closest stroke center? If they can do mechanical dissolution of the clot, that's preferable. But if they can't, they can take you to a hospital where they can initiate the IV medication and then ship you to a hospital that can do the mechanical therapy, so-called drip and ship versus being treated the mothership. Obviously, if you drip and ship, it's going to take a little bit longer. And we know that the outcome is better the quicker you administer therapy. They had 159 patients that had been treated with this mechanical thrombectomy, dissolving the clot mechanically using catheters and stents. 100 of those patients, by the way, had been transferred, that is, they had the drip and ship therapy, and 59 presented to the hospital that did the mechanical therapy first. And then they looked at the outcome 3 months later. Even though the drip and ship therapy took 57 minutes longer to get the mechanical therapy, because of the fact that they received the IV therapy first, they did just as well.
I think this provides, of course, a very persuasive confirmation of the fact that we know that TPA is really helpful as long as it's administered within a certain window. And even that window is expanding, as we've reported on before. I'm wondering about places where neither of these services are available.
There's a lot of telemedicine cropping up now. So especially out in West Texas, there'll be places where there is no neurology and really not even any hospitals. So when they present to a really small rural hospital that doesn't have these capacities, we can connect them with telemedicine. A doctor can actually see the patient and talk to them to try to ascertain, is this an acute stroke? And if so, provide instructions about how to initiate therapy, and then the patient can be transferred after that.
So we might also see this window expand between the administration of TPA and mechanical removal of the clot.
And that's just because in these very rural parts, it may take an hour or two to get someone to a major hospital.
All of this, of course, really great news about stroke management. And I'll just remind everyone again that, gosh, we all need to be educated that if you have the symptoms of a stroke, seek care right away because, gosh, there's so much we can do.
That's a great take-home message.
Okay, let's turn from here to the home team. I served up a truly startling paper that's in Science, a journal we don't report from that often. It's an analysis from a Johns Hopkins team of mutations that are involved with cancer. And gosh, where do those things come from? Are they genetic? Are they environmental? Or do they just turn up?
They had an initial paper in 2015, also in Science, that showed that the more often cells divide, the more likely they are to develop cancer. This further study took it a step further. Why don't you tell us about it?
What they did was they actually calculated how many of these mutations that are involved with cancer are related to genetics, are related to environment, or how many of them are really random. And the take-home message is that the majority of cancer mutations are random, that there's not anything we can do about them.
There are some things that are inherited. If you inherit a certain gene you are more likely to develop cancer. The BRCA gene is one of those, for example, with regard to breast cancer and ovarian cancer. But as our DNA replicates, there are random mistakes in that. Every time the cell divides, it's estimated there are random three mistakes that occur. Now, most of them don't cause cancer, thank goodness, but occasionally some do. And if you have more than one mistake, it increases your risk of cancer as well. And these are the random ones you're talking about. So, Elizabeth, you mentioned that about two-thirds of them are due to that, but it really varies by different cancer types. For example, with regard to lung cancer, only about a third of them were due to this random genetic mistakes in replication, and two-thirds of them were due to the environment that was smoking. The exact opposite is true for things like bone cancer, for example, where about 95% of them are due to random errors, and pancreatic cancer, in which about 75% are.
Right. There are two take-home messages as far as the authors are concerned relative to this paper. One of them is that people should not feel guilty when they have a cancer diagnosis, because so many people reflect on their past and say, wow, if only I hadn't done this or that. I've always lived a healthy lifestyle. Gosh, what happened? Was it the fondness for bacon that gave me this particular cancer? And for the majority of people, that's not the case. The second take home is that they believe that this demonstrates we really need to focus our efforts on early detection. Because if the majority are random errors that result in cancers, that early detection is going to be really critical instead of treatment or avoidance practices.
I agree with you. If many of them are random, we need to have early detection before the cancer becomes more widespread or untreatable. But on the flip side, it means somewhere between 30 and 40% have environmental issues. And the environmental issues that we have control over are cigarette smoking and obesity. In many people, it's just random.
Yep, that's exactly right. A little crazy. Let's turn from here then to something that's not random. In the Annals of Internal Medicine, something we've talked about on a multitude of occasions, steroid injections for lower back pain.
If you can identify people that have chronic low back pain for 3 months or more, and you can identify those that have active inflammation, and by the way, we can do that by doing an MRI. If we take those individuals, will they benefit from giving a single steroid injection? And if so, for how long? They took people that had chronic low back pain for 3 months or more, an MRI that showed that they had acute inflammation, half of them received a single steroid injection, the other half received a placebo injection. Those that received the steroid had improvement in their symptoms at 1 month. There was no benefit at 3 months and no benefit at 12 months either.
Of course, some people are in such intractable pain that the prospect of acute improvement is really attractive. I'm not sure that this study is going to cause people to totally abandon this practice.
I think that's a valid point. Would a second injection prolong that or get a better result? And we don't know the answer to that.
Well, as we've talked about before, we do know that a comprehensive approach that might employ things like acupuncture and exercise and physical therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, frankly, are helpful with regard to managing low back pain. Maybe there's some combination that's appropriate here.
In fact, they made a list of things that pretend who will not respond very well to therapy. And it's people that have depression, low educational levels, other chronic diseases as well. They just don't seem to respond quite as well. So addressing the other issues, as you describe, is more likely to give a longer lasting, more durable result.
Finally, then, let's turn to something else that's gotten a lot of media attention, but I'm not sure we've ever really talked about it before. Direct-to-consumer advertisements, in the case of testosterone, how much did they influence people coming to their physician and asking for that? That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
It was in 1997 that the FDA permitted televised direct-to-consumer advertising. In 2015, the AMA came out against it for concerns that there was a potential for misuse and abuse as well. The testosterone story may be a great example of that. What's happened is over the last 10 years, there's been a dramatic increase in direct-to-consumer advertising with regard to testosterone. Did that actually influence our use of either testosterone testing, administration of testosterone, or even prescribing testosterone without having your testosterone level checked? There was a direct correlation between the advertising and having your testosterone tested, being administered testosterone, and even being administered without having the blood checked. There's no good data that the testosterone helps. In fact, there's suggestions that it increases the risk of prostate cancer and cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And it's also an indictment in my mind of direct-to-consumer advertising. I think it's possible for folks to find out lots of information on the internet and from other sources where they can sift through things if they have a certain condition and they're interested in new medicines for that or what have you. I also think we've talked before about how physicians are influenced by pharma to also increase their prescribing of new drugs and all of that. I think this whole thing is in need of some pretty considerable oversight.
After the advertising, it takes the patient seeing it and wanting the therapy, but then it takes a willing physician that's allowing them to have it as well. I guess the indictment is on the physicians who really either don't know the data very well or are prescribing medications without good indications, and that falls on us.
On that sobering note, I'm of course going to talk about the science paper about cancer mutations this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.